figured I didn't want to embarrass you.
I don't imagine a long introduction is necessary for Lynn Knopfziger. Many of you have followed his career. Some of you have heard him recently on programs like McNeil Lair, so he's kept very much in our minds and consciousness. He's the veteran in Ronald Reagan's campaigns. Going back to 1966, he graduated from San Jose College when it was a college, now it's a state university. Spent 16 years as a reporter for the Copley newspapers, the last 8 years of that period in Washington. He covered the 60 and 64 presidential campaigns, and his association with President Reagan began through his brother, Neil, or as he calls him, Moon Reagan, who worked as a TV advisor in the Goldwater campaign. They met and had conversations, and Mr. Knopfziger suspects that the contact with Ronald Reagan prior to the 66 race for governor was something that in which Neil Reagan had a hand. After that campaign for the governor's office, he was asked to stay on, and he spent 2 years or a little less, perhaps, in the first term as communication director. But then he left and was deputy assistant to President Reagan and the President Nixon in the White House. After that, deputy chairman of the re-election campaign committee. First, deputy chairman of the Republican National for communication of the Republican National Committee, and then the re-election campaign in California. 73, 75, he set up his own political consulting business, and then came back in 76. In the beginning with the convention of 76 and Ronald Reagan's entrance into national politics. There were funds left over in 77 from that campaign, and he established a political action committee and ran it called the Citizens for the Republic. And in 78, in August, he started out in the Reagan campaign, then in the well-publicized difference with John Sears. He departed that campaign but came back in June, that history is pretty well known to most of you. He became press secretary in the campaign of 80, and then assistant to President Reagan for political affairs for about a year, even though he had expressed his desire to go back to California after that time. Since then, he has had his own political consulting firm, but has maintained throughout that period contacts with good friends such as Ed Meese and Bill Clark and others with whom he's had ties. So there's been a continuity here, California and the national scene, that practically no other political leader has had. That's one reason that Jim Young and I have been very anxious that Mr. Knopfziger visit us and take an important part in our Reagan oral history. And we're delighted to have you with us.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here. It's lovely down here. I came back from California yesterday, you come down here and it almost makes you forget that you really wish to be in California. I see where the president tried his best to follow this little gathering up, and I'll speak to some of his people about that. But anyway, I thought today that instead of trying to talk to you about Reagan policies and programs and those sorts of things, which one, you read about pretty thoroughly in the papers, and two, others can do much better because they have a they have been there with Reagan during segments, longer segments of the 8 years than I have been, and also more directly involved in policy matters. But so what I, instead of talking about those things, I thought I'd like to talk to you about Ronald Reagan as a person. And I really made this decision on an airplane coming back from California yesterday, and I did it because I'd been out making a speech, and the people I talked to, I was talking about the Bush administration. But the thing I discovered they really wanted to hear about was Ronald Reagan. And that's not unusual. Ronald Reagan seems to lie on the public mind today much more than most recent presidents, and in some ways even more than George Bush. My wife was listening to the radio yesterday and heard the news announcer announce that President Reagan was opening this education conference down here. So, you know, he corrected himself later on, but that's the kind of impact Ronald Reagan has had on this country, for better or for worse. So I thought maybe talking about Reagan, the man, might give a little insight to him as a person, and also to really why he was the kind of a president he was. I made some notes, which means I have to put on these Dime Store glasses of mine. My doctor says it's all right. And it's cheaper, too. Anyway. I think that I really do have a special perspective on Ronald Reagan. I don't mean to say that with any ego, but I have known him over the whole span of his political career. And that's not true of very many people, with the exception of Nancy. Even the people who started out with him when he first went into the governor's office did not have the advantage of having watched him become governor. And I was fortunate to spend almost a year there in that first gubernatorial campaign and watch him learn and watch him develop as a politician. So I think I do have a little different perspective. I've known Ronald Reagan since 1965. Actually, I don't know. I might as well confess and tell you that the first time I ever met him, I wasn't sober. Reporters being what they are, I had in June of 1965, there in Ohio, there was a series of 8 dinners called Salute to Ray Bliss, who at the time was the Ohio state chairman, later became the National Republican chairman, and a very well-known and very competent working politician, and it was a salute in which Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was still alive at the time, obviously, was going to make the major speech in Cleveland. So I was going out to Cleveland to cover that speech, but I had also heard that Ronald Reagan, who had become very famous as something besides an actor because of that speech he made in 1964 in the campaign, the speech they call it, he was coming to Ohio to speak at the dinner in Cincinnati. But on the day before that, which was June 8th, I know because it was my birthday, which was my excuse for not being sober, he was going up to a little town called Newark, Ohio, and do a fundraiser for John Ashbrook, who was a conservative congressman. And so they were having a reception for him first at the at a farm, some wealthy person's farm out in the country. And I went out there, was invited out, to, you know, I wanted to meet Ronald Reagan, see what he was like informally. Well, in those days, Ronald Reagan was not flying. Reagan had flown before the war, but after the war, he decided that the odds were against you. After airplanes got safe, he figured the odds were against you. And so he didn't fly again from, well, I would suspect 1945 or 46 up until he ran for governor in 1966, when we told him, if you're going to campaign in California, you have to fly. The state's just too big. So he did, and this is a digression, I know, but he wouldn't fly in anything less than a two-engine plane, and he even was reluctant about that. And for several years after he began flying, he and Nancy would fly separately because they were afraid, well, the airplane's going to crash and one of us has to live to take care of the kids. I used to say, take the kids with you and then it doesn't matter. Well, that didn't seem to get me anywhere either. But anyway, so he had come in on a train and therefore it was late. He got to the cocktail party just as everybody was leaving to go hear him speak. And I introduced myself to him, I remember that. But he kind of looked down his nose at me and I'm sure he said, what is this drunken reporter doing here? But that's the first time I met Ronald Reagan. I went and covered his speech and got up the next morning to write it, and I couldn't read my notes. Fortunately, by this time, I was kind of a senior reporter with Copley, and I could get away with things like that. But the next time I met him was on another rather auspicious occasion. It was the day the Watts riots broke out in California. And I had known I had to go to California for a meeting in San Diego with our publishers. And so I had called Moon Reagan and said, Moon, I'm coming out to California. I know your brother's going to run for governor, even though he was denying it. And so I'd like to interview him. So Moon set up a lunch for us at the Brown Derby in Hollywood. And Reagan, as usual, was late, about 20 minutes late. And he came in. Moon and I had been waiting for him, and he came in, and I got up and introduced myself, and I said, you probably don't remember, but we've met before. And he said, oh, yes, I do. So I dropped that subject quickly. And Reagan, as usual, and this is an interesting thing about Ronald Reagan, he was very coy about saying whether or not he would run. And it was clear that he would. He had a financial money-raising team put together, some very wealthy Republicans. He'd been going up and down the state making speeches. The talk was in all the papers that he was gonna run. This was obviously 1965. He would not say that he would. He would say, well, he might not. He was thinking about it. And actually, he didn't announce that he was going to run until January of 1966. And so you had a period there of well over 6 months when everybody but Ronald Reagan knew that he was going to run. But that's typical of him. He is always in these things, giving himself a chance to back out or not to go if it looked like it was not going to be the right thing to do. And he has a very good feeling about what is right for Ronald Reagan and what is not right for Ronald Reagan. A very good political sense there. In 1967, and this is something that you won't read in most books because most people don't know it actually. In December of 1966, several of us met in Reagan's house in Pacific Palisades and sat down and said, okay, he's been elected governor now, he hadn't even been sworn in, let's look and see what we can do about electing him president in 1968. And that once again, there were three or four of his very wealthy supporters there and three or four of us who were politicians. And out of that meeting, we the money people found the money to hire a man named F. Clifton White, whom some of you may know, he's the man who drafted Barry Goldwater in 1963. And he was hired to begin looking around the country to see whether or not Ronald Reagan should run for president. And by early 1968, a couple of us were pushing on, myself and Tom Reed, who later became Secretary of the Air Force under in the Ford administration. Tom and I were the prime movers in pushing Reagan to go. And he was very reluctant, and I think this time genuinely reluctant. we got him to agree to be a favorite son candidate. That's the way you control the delegation in California, and the California state delegation is it's not proportional. You win the primary, the presidential primary in California, and you control all the members of the delegation. And clearly, since he was governor, he should have controlled the delegation. The way to do that was to have his favorite son, which we pointed out to him, and he did. And but he was very reluctant to become a candidate. And you know, in retrospect, he was absolutely right. He felt that he had not even been governor for 2 years, and all of a sudden want to be president was presumptuous. And Tom Reed and I both felt that we run him before he has any political scars on him. We figured if he doesn't run, a Republican will probably win this thing. 8 years from now, Ronald Reagan will be a kind of an old hack politician, and besides that, he's going to be an old man. So anyway, we pushed and pushed, and he did almost nothing to help us. But after we got down to the convention in Miami Beach, and he was actually talking to delegates, and he kind of got excited and was interested in really making a serious run at it. And we said, well, the only way you can do that is to announce that you're no longer a favorite son, that you're a bona fide candidate. Well, actually, Bill Nolan, who had been the former United States Senator, is the guy who came up with that idea. So he accepted it, and I guess the day before they actually balloted there at the convention, he announced he was a full-fledged candidate for president, and it was too late, much too late. We hoped that if we could keep Nixon from winning on the first ballot, that there would be a slide toward Reagan, because many delegates would no longer be committed to Nixon. But the Nixon people knew that, and the Rockefeller people, and I'm sorry to say anything bad about Nelson Rockefeller, but Nelson Rockefeller knew how to win New York, but he had no idea how to win the presidency, and he had politicians around him who couldn't count delegates. And that's a fatal flaw if you're trying to make anybody president. And they thought they had enough delegates, so between us and them, we could stop Nixon. We knew that we didn't, but you couldn't convince them. So a couple of steps that might have been taken weren't taken, and so Reagan, of course, was not nominated there in 68. Nixon was. But Reagan said afterward, and this I think speaks well for him. He said it to me alone, and I know he said it to other people. And he said, "I don't feel badly about this." He said, "I was not ready," and I think that's interesting. He recognized that he did not have enough experience in governing to be comfortable as president. But the thing you always want to remember about presidents, you never know whether they're going to be any good or not until they get into the White House. I mean, there are some presidents that, such as Harding, who everybody thought would be a great president before he got in. And, you know, you really have to wait and see how a person acts under those kinds of pressures. And I don't think that the man himself knows how he's going to react until he gets in there. Reagan, incidentally, was certainly a different kind of a president, but he was a different kind of a governor. He was the same kind of governor as he was president. He was a man who didn't really take himself all that seriously. So many men who are elected governor or president think that maybe that they were anointed by the Lord to serve, and therefore they should not be questioned, and they know everything there is to know, and one should not argue with them. Not the case with Reagan. He never took himself seriously, and he never thought the job was the kind of a job that a man ought to work 18 or 20 hours a day. He did not do that. I think he instinctively knew, and I happen to agree with this, that the job of a chief executive of the president, and maybe to a little lesser extent a governor, but governor of California is kind of a complicated job too, was not to try to manage or micromanage the government. Jimmy Carter's main flaw was that he could see every tree, but he had trouble seeing the forest. And so he worried about things such as who, literally, when he first came in there, he was keeping a schedule of who played tennis on the White House tennis courts. He was worrying about who his senior staff people hired as their secretaries. Well, no president should worry about that. I mean, that's not his job. And Reagan understood that, and maybe understood it a little too well, but he always looked at the job as he, as governor or president, should be the man who set the policy, who laid out the philosophy of government, who said what direction we're going in, and then who was there to make the tough decisions and the major decisions. And he did that. He had a knack for doing that, and for never looking back when he made a tough decision. I remember shortly after he became governor, there was a cop killer who was up for execution, and the laws had just been changed again so you could go ahead and execute people. Nobody had been executed in California for about 7 years. Pat Brown executed one man and found the situation too harrowing, and so he never executed anybody else. Kept postponing it. So this cop killer came up, and Reagan was tortured by it. He prayed. He's a devout Christian. He talked to his minister. He talked to others, and then he went ahead and let the execution go forward. And he never really looked back at it. I mean, there were never any what-ifs, at least publicly. He made the decision. He was able to move on. Incidentally, he never either executed another person in that state. It must be, for a person of some sensitivity, which he is, it must be a very difficult thing to make that decision. I had no trouble with it, but I didn't have to make the decision. He, as I say, he could make those tough decisions and go on. At the same time, he's a man who has a great feeling for the people around him. This is going to be a kind of an anecdotal ramble here that you get from here on. I'd like to illustrate that. Here's a man who, you know, many of the press has said over the years that he was cold-hearted and didn't care and so forth. But he cares about people. When he was governor, first became governor, we all went in there to run the state, and we thought we were very important people, and we stayed and worked long hours, shuffling papers and all those important things. And Reagan, being a smart man, would close up his office about 5 or 5:30 and go home. Came in about 8:30 or 9 in the morning. Once in a while, we could get him up early to have a 7:30 breakfast, but you shouldn't do that with Reagan. He's no good in the morning, no good in the morning at all. No good late at night either. He's a man. Yeah, he's a man who will tell you bluntly. He says, oh, "Listen, I need 8 hours sleep, and I do better on 9." I used to tell people that he was a half a disciple of Benjamin Franklin. He believes in early to bed. But anyway. He would, the press would comment on this terrible man who was going home early when the state was falling apart, which of course was not true. But he would take his reading home, and he liked to go home, put on his pajamas, and sit there and read stuff, and in between watch television or vice versa. And he did not expect the people who were working for him to put in those long hours. He would come down the California governor's office. Is built in a square around a patio, and the governor's own office is over in one corner, and then the offices of his senior staff are around the quadrangle. And he would come walking down the corridor, and he'd stick his head into offices, and there'd be a meeting going on or something, and he'd say, "Gee, fellas, it's time to go home. Go home to your wife and kids, you know." And we, being very important people, said, "Well, who's going to get all the work done?" And he has said on more than one occasion, and he was absolutely right, he said, "Look, it doesn't matter. Most of it doesn't matter whether you get it done." And he was right. He was absolutely right. And the problem with this country is not that we don't have good government, it's that we got too much government. And he instinctively understood that. He was really worried about the effect that this job would have on people's families. And I've known an awful lot of people who've had marriage troubles and who've gotten divorces because of the fact that they spent too much time in their government offices and got too close to their government secretaries and didn't go home soon enough. I have a personal example that I'd like to share with you about the kind of caring man Reagan is. In the campaign of 1966, we had come in, by this time we had Reagan flying again, and we had come into LA International Airport. And we were going to have a press conference there, and it was in the summertime, and we came in, and my wife and two daughters, we were still living in Virginia, had come out to California for the summer, and they had come down to the airport to meet me and greet me, not having seen very much of me for the last 6-7 months. And we came in, and I said, "Now, we got business here. If you would just stand to one side, I'll talk to you after we're through." So we went and held our press conference, and I went ahead and picked them up, and we went home, and I didn't think anything more about it. But a few days later, we were up at Lake Tahoe, and we were having a kind of a brainstorming session at a big fancy cabin up there, which had a large veranda overlooking the lake. And three or four of us were outside having a drink before dinner. And Reagan wandered out, and he saw me, and he said, "Lynn, I want to talk to you." And so he took me over to the side, and he said, "Lynn, you've got to be nicer to your wife and children." And I said, "What in the hell are you talking about?" "Well," he said, "the other day when we came into LAX, you were pretty rude to him." Now, the candidate should not have been paying any attention to this. He should have been worrying about his press conference. But anyway, I said, "Look, it was all right. They understood." He said, "Take it from an old married man. Got to be nicer to your wife and children." I said, "Hey, I've been married longer than you." And he said, "Not if you count both of my wives." So he is a caring man, and talking about both his wives, I think maybe, and we all like to be amateur psychologists, maybe the single thing in Ronald Reagan's life that affected him most was his divorce from Jane Wyman, because he didn't want it. She walked away from him on the grounds basically that he was boring, which is interesting. Clearly she wasn't interested in politics, and he'd always been interested in politics, even though he'd been a Democrat, but he'd been active in the Screen Actors Guild, and been, what, 5-6 years the president of it, and he was interested in these kinds of things, and she apparently was interested in the social life of Hollywood. So she left, and it left him feeling very empty, and with a feeling that this should not have happened. He was raised pretty much in a Puritan type family. His father had been an alcoholic and a Catholic, but his mother was a Church of Christ, Disciples of Christ, and very devout, and that the boys had been raised in that church. And he thought divorce was wrong. And so when he married Nancy Davis, I am sure that he said in his own mind that nothing is ever going to destroy this marriage. And Nancy's not the easiest lady in the world to live with. I don't think. I've never lived with her, but I've been around her. And I think anybody who's been around Ronald Reagan will tell you that he has always walked that extra mile to make sure that that marriage stayed together. Well, probably would have anyway, but this was just the part of his life that had to do with Jane Wyman is a part that he's tried to put to one side and take a hold of his life with Nancy and make sure that that was right. If you will read his autobiography, Where's the Rest of Me, the one that he wrote in 1965, you'll find that he dispenses with his first marriage in about two paragraphs. You know, well, that's incredible. But it's just the way he is. One of the things that most people who've been close to Ronald Reagan, and that includes me, find is that there's a kind of a veil between Ronald Reagan and the rest of the world. You never really feel that you've gotten inside the guy, even if you know him well. And I traveled with him alone every day for 9 months. And we'd sit in the back of the car or on the plane together, one thing or another, and you'd get to know somebody pretty well. But you always felt there was something there between Ronald Reagan and the rest of the world. I don't know whether Nancy feels it or not, but but I don't know anybody who has been close to Reagan who doesn't feel that. And I don't know whether it's a protective mechanism, if it's something that happened to him because he grew up as a poor boy. I don't know whether it's because as a movie actor you're kind of harried by people who want autographs and want to get next to you and all that, and he was protecting himself from that. I don't know whether he decided that after Jane Wyman he was never going to let anything hurt him again, or what, but there is a veil there. And I'd like, a friend of mine who knows Ronald Reagan real well wrote me a letter one time, and I'd like to read you just a little quote from it, because it kind of reflects my own frustration with Ronald Reagan in this way. And he said, "Which is the real Ronald Reagan, the benign flesh and blood man next to us in the plane seat, or the disembodied searching spirit hovering out there in air too thin for us to breathe?" And he went on to say, after he'd been talking about Ronald Reagan's achievements, and he listed them in their legion, my friend notes, quote, "The most puzzling irony of all is that that these achievements have left him cool, unvain, incurious, and as private as a Trappist monk." And that's right. I mean, I don't know. But once again, unless it's Nancy. Nancy says, "What you see is what you get." I used to say that too, but it isn't that simple, believe me. And she's, and she knows it isn't. He is a very private man, and it's very hard to find out just what is going in that mind of his. Reagan is a lot more than just a cool, unvain, incurious, and that's not quite true. In some ways he's incurious, other ways he's an omnivorous reader, and if you're an omnivorous reader, you can't be entirely uncurious or incurious. I think what my friend was driving at, that his curiosity is not what is going on today, but kind of a general curiosity that we all have. As I say, he has to be more than this kind of a distant critter, because too many people love him. And you don't love somebody who is distant from him. I love him, you know. And the people who have worked for him over the years, people who before they have known him have not liked him or have hated him or who have been contemptuous of him, come to know him and then to respect him, but more than that, to love him. I think if you would talk to Ed Meese or to Bill Clark or to Kathy Osborne, who's his personal secretary, or to just literally hundreds of people who have come to know him in a rather close and intimate way, they will tell you they love Ronald Reagan. Howard Baker, who certainly was, who became Ronald Reagan's chief of staff by accident, terrible accident, but Howard's a nice man, but Reagan was very contemptuous of him, hated him because of the Panama Canal, thought he was a lightweight, and Howard Baker thought much the same about Ronald Reagan, thought he was a lightweight, didn't know much, and Howard went in there at the insistence of Paul Laxalt and became his chief of staff, and Howard Baker became, you know, very much of a fan of Ronald Reagan, an admitted fan. Same was true of Margaret Heckler, the congresswoman who lost to Barney Frank and later became Ronald Reagan's secretary of HHS, which I get blamed for and I'm not to blame for. But we'll tell you the same thing. I love Ronald Reagan. So there is more to him, much more to him than that. He has, interestingly, I think, for a politician, if many times a politician can kind of stir the masses, but as an individual, he's not all that good, or in dealing with individuals, or a person can be very good with individuals and has trouble getting across to people as a whole. but Reagan is unique because he has an appeal both of those ways. I keep going back to the campaign of 66 because it's the time when I really got to know him, and also because Ronald Reagan has not changed over the years. It's an amazing thing to me. So many people come into politics and they get elected to the state legislature and they get a little bit of ego, and they get elected then to the state senate and there's a little more ego, and then they get to be the United States representative and they think they're pretty important, and they wind up as governor or United States senator or running for president, and as I say, they think the Lord has anointed them. And Reagan has never got that way. He is today the same nice man, as far as being an individual, that he was 25 years ago. It's really incredible to me. You can still talk with him, you can still argue with him, you can still sit down and tell jokes with him. People will, you know, once in a while when Reagan was president, a call would come in from the White House, and on I'd be somewhere. And people say, oh, and, you know, and they'd sneak up and they'd say, Mr. Nofsek, the president wants to talk to you. You know, and everybody would hear this sort of voice, whisper. And they think, my God, Nofsek is being consulted on matters of state. No, the president had run into a joke that he thought I'd like. You know, and he's found me in Colorado, and he's found me in California, and just about anywhere else that I might be to tell me a joke. He didn't need my advice on how to run the country. He did it very well by himself. But he is a nice man and a caring man. He is a moral man. I've always blessed Ronald Reagan because he's one of not very many candidates who, when you put him to bed, stays in bed. He's not out chasing. He's not much of a drinker. I've never seen him take more than a couple of drinks, usually one. So you don't have to worry about him getting drunk. If he misspeaks himself, it's done because he's cold sober. He'd have probably been better off with a couple of drinks. But I remember this kind of funny story about his drinking. We were on an airplane one day, and there was some press traveling with us, including one reporter that he didn't like at all. Thought the man had lied about him and one thing or another, which is probably true. And so we're sitting in our seats here, and this reporter and a couple other reporters are across the aisle, and the stewardess came down and she said, what would you like to drink? And he said, you know what I mean? He said, I'd really like a gin and tonic. But he said, if I have that SOB across the aisle is going to write that I'm a heavy drinker. I guess he wanted a split of champagne. That's what it was. So instead of a split of champagne, he had a Diet Coke or something, before the days of Diet Coke. And then he looked across the aisle and he saw the guy who he hated had ordered a split of champagne. And he sat there and he cursed him under his breath to me, you know, as if the guy had deliberately done something. But he's not a drinker. He's a gentleman. He's the kind of a person who helps a lady into her chair, pulls out the chair for him, opens the door of the car for him. While he can tell a dirty joke as well as anybody, I have never heard him make an off-color remark around a woman. He is a courtly, old-fashioned gentleman. I mean, he's the kind of a guy that your mother hoped you ladies would marry. That is a little unusual in today's politicians at all. He is certainly no no Lyndon Johnson. Yet at the same time, he's very much of a man's man. I mean, and men like his company. He's an outdoorsman, as you know. He rides horses. Interestingly, he learned to ride horses. He was a poor boy growing up in Illinois, and he always wanted to ride horses, couldn't afford it. So after he grew up and got a job as a radio announcer, he joined the Cavalry National Guard so he could learn to ride horses. And actually, he was a member of the cavalry when World War II came along, and of course, we had no horses then. By then, and so they stuck him in this outfit that was making movies for national morale. I remember, once again, in the campaign of 1966, he had a ranch outside of Los Angeles, just northwest of the San Fernando Valley, in a place called Malibu Canyon. And he had 100 100 or so acres out there, and he was raising a few thoroughbreds, which he liked. He was, you know, he always lost money on thoroughbreds, and never raced them, just raised them and lost money on them, but he could afford it. And he loved to ride them, and he loved to jump. So when he'd go riding, and he wouldn't wear blue jeans like us Western cowboys do. He'd go put on some jodhpurs and some boots and go riding his horse over the jumps and things. So one day, a television reporter said, "I would love to come out and do a feature on Ronald Reagan on his ranch riding." So we said, "Fine, this is great. Yeah, I'm a really good PR." So Reagan and I go out to the ranch to get him ready to be in this television segment. And he comes strolling out of the house in jodhpurs and boots. And I looked at him and I said, "Where are your jeans?" "Well," he says, "I'm gonna ride the horse over the jump." I said, "Damn it, Ron, you can't do that here. You're in California. You're a Westerner. If the people in this state see you like that, they're gonna think you're a slave. You know, I said, "I suppose you're gonna use an Eastern saddle too." And he said, "Well, of course, you know." And I said, "You can't do it, you know." So he very reluctantly and grouchily went back in and put on a pair of jeans and threw a Western saddle on his horse, and we got a great bit of publicity. You know, and you wouldn't have to tell him that today. But he is very much an outdoors man. He loves to go to that ranch of his and chop wood and clear brush and that sort of thing. He's a kind of a natural athlete. I can tell the story, I guess. He just wasn't really a nut on golf, but he was really quite a good golfer when he was playing. So he went out there and they said, "What's your handicap?" And, you know, he hemmed and hawed and said he was a lousy golfer or anything. And then he says, "You know, it was a terrible thing." He said, "I went out and shot one of the best rounds I've ever shot." He said, "I was so embarrassed I didn't know what to do." He is a guy who likes to ride, who likes to work with his hands and things. He's not a hunter, he's not a fisherman, but he is an outdoorsman. So he is in many respects what you'd have to call a regular guy, and men like him, and women like him. And dogs like him, which I think means more than if men and women like him. you've got all this, and you say, "Well, there's a regular guy." He's the kind of guy you'd like to sit down and have a beer with. I mean, really, he's the kind of a guy. I think one of the things that really elects him is the fact that the average blue-collar guy, Ronald Reagan's not a blue-collar man. He grew up poor and delighted in making money. You know, I've been rich and I've been poor, and rich is better, and he knows that. I mean, he makes no bones about it. He doesn't, there's no "aw shucks" kind of thing. I'm not really well-to-do, I really don't want all these trappings of power. He loves them. But at the same time, he doesn't demand them, he accepts them. As I say, one of the things I'm convinced that elects him is that the average guy sitting there with his can of beer watching Ronald Reagan feels a kinship with him. Don't ask me why, but I think I need to digress a minute, though, and tell you that nobody uses a television camera. Nobody in the whole world uses a television camera better than Ronald Reagan as an instrument of getting to people. And of course, he had a lot of experience. He had television experience when he had live television in GE Theater. And one of the things he'll tell you, and this was entirely different from what other people used to say, but I think they've all come to the conclusion, He says, the camera, you're not looking at a lens on the camera. You're looking through the lens to some guy sitting in his living room. And you are talking to that particular person. He is an individual sitting there, two or three of them. And you're looking right at the lens and you're talking to him. And that's what he always did. He used the camera as a means of communicating, not to 20 million people, but to 20 million individuals. And he looked him in the eye, and he said, you gotta look him in the eye. And he also said, the camera, he believes this. I'm not sure I agree with him, but he believes it. The camera does not lie. If you're a phony, you'll come across as a phony. If you're sincere and well-meaning, you're going to come across as sincere and well-meaning, which is not only interesting, but I've got another little anecdote that may back that up. My old friend Jesse Unruh, and I don't know how many of you remember Jesse Unruh. He was, I think, maybe the best tour politician to come along in California ever, maybe. He was a Democrat, Speaker of the State Assembly. Could have been elected to the United States Senate, where I'm convinced he would have made Lyndon Johnson look like a rank amateur. But he wanted to be governor of the state of California, and he ran against Ronald Reagan in 1970, and that wasn't very smart, because Jess was short and ugly. And short and ugly doesn't come across on television as well as tall and handsome. And being smart wasn't enough. Jess is dead now, but 3 or 4 years ago I was out in Palm Springs making a speech, and he was down there making a speech to the same group of people. And so after we finished, we went off and had a lunch together. And he said, you know, we were talking about Reagan. He said, the difference between Reagan and most politicians is that Reagan believes what he says. He says he can say 2 and 2 are 4 now, and he can say 2 and 2 are 6 10 minutes from now, and he absolutely believes 2 and 2 are 6. And he says, I might say 2 and 2 are 4 now, and 10 minutes later say 2 and 2 are 6, and he says, everybody knows I'm lying. And he says, that is the difference politically between Ronald Reagan and most politicians. Ronald Reagan believes absolutely what he is telling you at the time. So he sounds sincere because he is sincere. Whereas Jess Unruh says, I'm not going to sound sincere when I tell you 2 and 2 are 6 because I know it isn't 6. But he said, Ronald Reagan is convinced it is. And Ronald Reagan is convinced that kind of sincerity, and he didn't make up that, I mean, that's the way he is, but that kind of sincerity comes across on television. You know, and yet, despite all these things, there's a... sometimes you feel that, that Reagan kind of lives in a world of his own. This guy was talking about him being off in air, too thin for the rest of us to breathe. Well, I suppose that's a good way of putting it as anything. But when he is not focused on the things he has to do, why, sometimes you have this feeling that he is off, as I say, in a world of his own. And he won't think about things that he ought to do. Somebody has to come along, not important things, but somebody has to come along and remind him, say, hey, Governor, hey, Mr. President, or hey, Ron, so-and-so has just died. You ought to call his widow. Oh, yeah. Of course. Now, he wouldn't think of it by himself, you know. I think one of the reasons is he's such a private man that he doesn't like to appear to be intruding or interfering into other people's affairs or other people's personal problems or sorrows or anything. So then he'll make the telephone call or he'll write the letter, and nobody does it better. I'd like to hire Ronald Reagan as a professional phone callers for me, so when somebody I know dies, he can call the widow and commiserate with them on my behalf, because nobody in the world does it better than he does. And the letters he writes are beautiful letters. I mean, in after Reagan was out of the governor's office, the woman who'd been his personal secretary all those years, Helene Von Damme, had collected a lot of his letters and decided she would write a book about Ronald Reagan and the letters he wrote. Well, Helene had no particular background in writing anything except Ronald Reagan's letters, so I wound up ghosting the book for her. As a result, I read hundreds of Ronald Reagan letters, and they are just outstanding. The book should have, we made a paperback book out of it, and it didn't sell very well. This was in 76. But it ought to be taken out and redone and probably updated, because letters of advice to his children, letters of advice to other people's children, letters in response to people who had been critical of him, in which he was always friendly and understanding and saying, hey, you know, we don't have to get mad at each other even though we differ. But he does those things very well. But most of the time, if he's going to do them, somebody has to say, hey, Ron, you ought to write a letter to so-and-so. I'm sure many of the other people who've been close to him, if we hear that something has happened to somebody that we know Reagan knows, who already worked for Reagan, we'll call the secretary and say, hey, did you know that such and such happened? And she will take the word in doing that. You know, and I have personal knowledge of that. We had a kind of a poignant thing happen. My daughter had to go into the hospital on January 20th of this year, which was the last day he was in office. And the last telephone call Ronald Reagan made from his office was a telephone call to Georgetown University Hospital looking for my daughter, to, you know, to cheer her up and so forth. And, you know, he couldn't find her, by the way. They were out looking for Susan Nofziger, and unfortunately she was married. But so I wound up talking to my wife. But nevertheless, he is that kind of a caring man, and I'm sure. Well, as a matter of fact, I know. I looked around to see how he had found out about her, because I hadn't told him. And somehow or other, his daughter Maureen had heard, and she had told her father about it, and so he called. So that is the kind of thing, I guess, that makes you love Ronald Reagan. You know, he's a nice man. He can, he doesn't really hold a grudge, but once in a while, but he can get a fixation, like the rest of us. He has a terrible time firing people. I think that's probably his weakness. His other weakness is he's not very good at hiring people. But, well, I'll have to talk to you about both of those. I only know of two instances where he ever personally, only one where he ever personally fired people, and only a couple where he even set out himself to have somebody fired. The rest of the time we had to go to him and say, hey, you got to fire so-and-so. But it's something that he doesn't like to do. The only time he fired anybody was on election day of the primary in New Hampshire in 1980, when he called in John Sears. That was one of the great days in my life. And he called in John Sears and Jim Lake and Charlie Black and fired them. I had known since the day before that it was going to happen, and as I say, it was one of the great days of my life. But one other case, he demanded that a man be fired, and he made him fire this particular man over the objections of his campaign management. He felt the man had goofed up 3 or 4 times badly, and Reagan began to think it was deliberate. It wasn't deliberate. The guy was dumb. But Ronald Reagan was easier for Ronald Reagan to think that he was malicious than he was dumb. I don't know whether that's good or bad. But you know, on hiring people, most of the people in his administration he didn't hire. And one of the things that happened to him, especially as president, was that people were hired who were not really loyal to Ronald Reagan. Didn't mean they weren't competent, but many of the people in the White House, and it got worse as time went on, had never worked for Reagan, didn't really agree with him philosophically, in contrast to when he was governor, when the people who he brought in around him, almost without exception, were strong pro-Reagan people who believed the way he did philosophically and so forth. And one of the things I think that happened in the White House, and my feeling is that Ronald Reagan was a very good president, but he could have been a better president if he paid more specific attention to who was working for him. You know, his first chief of staff had been George Bush's man. His second chief of staff had been a guy who contributed to Democrats in the 1980 campaign, Don Regan. His third chief of staff was Howard Baker, who obviously was a more liberal Republican than Reagan and hadn't agreed with him on many things. And his last chief of staff was Ken Duberstein, who's a very nice fella, but who came out of Jack Javits' Senate office initially. I mean, much more liberal Republican. Doesn't mean they're bad people, but it's very hard for when you have a man who has an ideology and a philosophy of government strongly like Reagan does, to bring in people who don't agree with him on that philosophy of government means you're not going to get as much done as you might have otherwise. But Reagan didn't like that. I mean, the whole personnel thing is something that is just makes him uncomfortable. Hell, Ronald Reagan never hired me, never once hired me, never once fired me either, although there are reporters who will tell you he has 3 or 4 times. I maintain I quit. I keep saying, listen, if I'd been fired, I wouldn't have been dumb enough to go back and ask for more. But when he was elected president, now, of course, obviously he has to hire people, but other people, for the most part, are around selecting, recommending. He hired Jim Baker as his chief of staff. Haley hardly knew Jim Baker, but Baker had impressed Nancy, had impressed Mike Deaver, had impressed Drew Spencer, who had run his campaigns in California in 66 and 70 and was close to Baker. So he hired Jim Baker. The one guy, or one of the few people that he hired personally into his cabinet, he could never brag about that because another guy thought that he was responsible for it. It's kind of a funny little story. Bill Clements, who was the governor of Texas, is the governor of Texas, came out to see Reagan up at Pacific Palisades. I guess it was probably in late November of 1980. And we always tried to have somebody with Reagan when one of these politicians was there to see him, because we never quite trusted Reagan. He's a nice man, and sometimes he's apt to give away the store, which you don't want. I was up at the house with Reagan, and Bill Clements came in, and he talked about a number of things. He finally came to his point, which was he was wanted to recommend Cap Weinberger to be Secretary of Defense. Now, he'd worked in the Nixon administration as Deputy Secretary of Defense when Cap was there as Secretary of HHS and head of the Federal Trade Commission, head of the Office of Management and Budget and so forth. So he knew Cap and he liked him. But just as importantly, he didn't like John Tower, who also wanted to be Secretary of Defense. So anyway, he recommended Reagan that Cap be Secretary of Defense, and Reagan was very noncommittal. He accepted that. And eventually Bill Clements went away. And Reagan turned to me and he said, I didn't want to tell him this. But he said, last night I was lying in bed thinking about this. And he said, it finally occurred to me, I'm going to name Cap Weinberger Secretary of Defense. But he said, I didn't want to tell him that. He's going to think that I've stolen his idea. So he went ahead and named Cap Weinberger Secretary of Defense. And until this day, as far as I know, Bill Clements thinks it's his idea. But most of the people who came into that administration weren't either came in asking for the job, like Bill Smith, or being recommended and were not close to Reagan at all. He did not have a list of people who he was gonna hire. Heck, he didn't even have a list of the Carter people who should have been fired. I had a hell of a time getting rid of some of those Carter people. Which and that turned out to be one of my jobs in the White House. It was a job I enjoyed immensely, but it wasn't a job that Reagan really cared anything about. He has this funny problem. He thinks that if you work for him, you like him, and you're going to be loyal to him. And he's right about 90% of the time. And unfortunately, the other 10% of the time can create problems. So anyway, I think one of the points I was going to make was that he's a trusting man. And I think that makes that point pretty well. I think, interestingly, I'm really run over, haven't I?
It's okay.
He's a man with good political instincts. He's a man who instinctively knows, I think I said this before, what is good for him politically. He knows when he ought to announce that he's running for office. Not only there as governor, did he wait till the last minute? I'm a hawk in these things. I want a guy in there early so you can begin to raise money, so you can begin to put things together, so you can get a show on the road. Reagan, who does nothing but win, is too dumb to listen to him. So we got into we put the 66 campaign together, started putting it together in July of 65. We couldn't get him to announce until late November of 65. We began putting the thing together in March of 1979. We couldn't get him to announce until late November. Of 79. So he will wait until a time when he feels he is comfortable with this. And to heck with all of you politicians who think you know what you're doing. He's a guy, who will make those major decisions. His decision... in 1966, Stu Spencer and Bill Roberts were running his campaign, and they are very good professional politicians. They are, Bill is dead now, but they are two of the best political operatives I have ever known. They had to be good, they hired me. We all make mistakes. They were leery of Reagan when they went on to run Reagan for governor. They'd been hired to do that. And they thought that, Reagan was not real smart. They thought that he certainly was inexperienced in politics, which he was. And so they wanted to put tight controls over him. And the stories that were running in the papers were indeed that he was a controlled candidate, that he memorized his answers and his speeches and that he would be a total disaster if he was left on his own. Well, Bill and Stu thought they could get through with this kind of thing, and Reagan felt very strongly that they couldn't. And so over their objections, he said, I'm going to start taking questions. And at every speech, and just remember, this was in 66, and this was the height of the time when there were problems with Vietnam, but there were problems on the campuses, especially in California, University of California. There was a lot of turmoil in the state and in the country. And here was this this actor thinking he could be governor of California. And he decided, and he was right, I have to prove to these people that I'm more than an actor. And he did it. He took questions. Everywhere he went, he took questions. And he did his homework, and he answered those questions. And he made very few mistakes. And I think that is one of the reasons why he won so handily. I felt all along he would win. I'd come back. I'd been out with him two or three times, and I came back one time and said to Bill Roberts, I said, you know, there's something out there between Ronald Reagan and the people. I don't know what it is. I can't put a handle on it, but there's something there, and he's going to be elected. And I said, you know, if he's elected governor, he could even be president one day. I like to brag about this. But the thing that is really funny is that Bill Roberts turned to me and he said, oh, Lynn, what will that poor soul do if he ever gets elected governor? So, you know, there was not a hell of a lot of confidence in Ronald Reagan at that time. And I was just naive enough to think that there was something there. But so the decision to debate in 1980 was one he made by himself. Now, he made it, and then we did a lot of discussing about it, but it's another little kind of interesting story. I got up one morning in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and said to myself, gee, and I'd been opposed to it, we're going to have to debate. This campaign is just flat, and we've got to do something to get it moving. So I went down to see Stu Spencer, who was packing, and he looked up from his suitcase and said, you know, Lynn, we're going to have to debate. And I said, you SOB, I came down here to tell you that. And that day, just per chance, I rode out to the airplane alone with Ronald Reagan. And we're sitting there talking. And he said, you know, Lynn, we're going to have to debate. And I said, damn you. I said, I have talked to Stu about this, and we're going to get to the airplane, and you're going to say we have to debate, and they're going to think that I came to you and talked you into this. And then they're all going to be mad at me. But so I got on the airplane first, went running around the student saying, hey, Reagan decided this on his own. But he instinctively understood, and I think we might have won anyway, but he understood that things were not moving and something had to be done. Good political instinct. And one other thing there, quickly. In 1976, he had lost 5 primaries in a row. And people were beginning to want him out of the race. Nancy didn't want him embarrassed. She would have been much happier if he'd gotten out then. And his political instincts told him that this was not the end. I mean, and he said, I walked in, I'd come down from Washington to North Carolina where we were campaigning, and I'd walked into the suite and Nancy immediately grabbed me and began telling me I ought to tell Ronald Reagan to get out of the race. And he came in and he said, and he thought that I was telling Nancy that, and he said, Lynn, I'm not going to get out of the race. He said, I'm going to stay in this thing to the end. And yes, some of it was the fact that he's a fighter. He didn't want to leave on a losing note. But the other one was that he knew, you know, and we knew, There were a lot of people in this country who wanted Ronald Reagan to be president, and he was fighting really overwhelming odds by fighting a sitting Republican president. And but he sensed the same thing out there that I think some of the other fellows did, that it wasn't over. So he has made some of these tough political decisions, as well as the tough decisions in the White House. So let me sum it up, because I've talked much too long. I think basically that Ronald Reagan is a unique figure, certainly in the politics of the United States since World War II. Whether he's a great president, I can't tell you. I don't think his second term was as good as his first term. But he's a man, he's a man for all seasons. He's a man that you can trust. He's a man that you can believe. He's a man who doesn't take himself too seriously. He's a man who never got a fat head because he became an important person. And I think when you put all his qualities together, and he's got some bad ones, he'll get mad, he'll curse, he'll throw his glasses, but when he throws his glasses, it's for effect. I have known 4 or 5 presidents, and I'm not sure, and I can tell you this, Ronald Reagan was not the smartest of them, but also not the dumbest. But he's a man whose qualities endear him to people, and he's a man who has the one, I think, important quality for a president. He can make a decision. And you have to make a decision if you're president, whether it's right or wrong. Jimmy Carter's problem was he had a tough time making a decision. Ronald Reagan's never had that problem. He can make a decision, and I think I think that's what made him a successful president. Thank you all very much. Nobody's ever let me talk this long before.
Why don't we have a few questions? Jim Young and his research scholars will be meeting after this session if Mr. Knopfziger is willing for
I'll stay as long as you want, as long as I don't have to run into the traffic.
But I think we should have some questions. Dr. Aldridge?
Mr. Knopfziger, you said
he's
that...
a psychiatrist.
Well, don't brush any of those off onto me.
Said that President Carter was administratively more concerned about the trees and the forest, mm-hmm. and President Reagan mm-hmm. was the opposite. Mm-hmm. And in your illustrations about President Reagan as a caring person, mm-hmm. most of them had to do with his caring about individuals. Mm-hmm. But with respect to groups, classes, the unemployed, as evidenced by the classified ad comment and mm-hmm. so on, he seemed particularly unconcerned. Should not the chief executive be more focused on the forest than on the trees in his caring as well as in his administration?
Well, I think a president being a human being ought to care about individuals as well as care about the forest. But I think it's easy to say that Ronald Reagan didn't care about people as a mass because that's what you read in the papers. But if you will look at the record, social programs were not cut. They did not rise as fast as they had been rising, but they were they were not cut under Ronald Reagan. And I think that as far as I'm concerned, he did care about people in the mass. But you know, it's very hard to illustrate a man by saying he cared about people in the mass, unless you say he went out and raised the budget by so much to help people. And yet, you know, there are those who believe that that the hand of Big Brother helping people is not necessarily the best way to go. He had a belief that that the individual person in the community also had a duty to help his fellow man, that it was not just government that should help.
Next question, Professor Fernbach.
I wonder, sir, if you have any insider feeling about the chemistry between Reagan and Gorbachev.
Yeah, I do a little. I'd like to illustrate some of it. Here I go again with individuals, but when he went first to meet with was first going to meet with Gorbachev, there was a lot of stuff in the paper about Reagan going to give the store away and that sort of thing, and there was concern. and a concern among a lot of conservatives, including me, and I called down to the White House, and I said, I want to see the president. And they let me see him by myself up in the living quarters. And I went and I said, Mr. President, I'm speaking for a lot of concerned conservatives who are worried that you're going to give away the store here. And he said, Lynn, stop, I don't want you to worry. He said, I still have the scars on me from when I was fighting the communists in the movie industry, and he said, I understand them, and I'm not going to give anything away. Having said that, there is no question that he and Gorbachev hit it off. But, you know, Reagan hits it off with most people. If you will give him a chance, he will be your friend. You have to be antagonistic toward him before he becomes antagonistic toward you. And there was a very good relationship with Gorbachev, who apparently is also a very charming man.
Next question.
Andrew?
Yes.
I'd like to know, what are the qualities that President Reagan expected and valued most in the staff and those close to him? You indicated before loyalty is one.
Well, I think he expects loyalty. I think that he's not out seeking loyalty, that he thinks anybody who works for him is going to be loyal to him. Otherwise, he expects them to be competent. He expects them to be able to handle the details of government, because he's not the guy who's going to handle them. So, you know, and I would say beyond that, he's the usual expectations of wanting somebody who is competent I can't even say that he expects them, or that he wants them to share his political beliefs, because he's brought in people who he knew didn't, but he expected that they would be loyal to him and carry out his wishes, even though they might not agree with him.
Next question. Howard Cromwell.
Do you think that Ronald Reagan would oppose Gerry Ford in the race to be elected president? Had Ford actually been elected?
No, I don't think he would have. Had Ford been elected president, I think Ronald Reagan would have been out there campaigning for him. You want to remember that after Ford became president, one of the early things he said is, I will not seek election to another term. Beyond that, Reagan felt that Ford had never been elected vice president, never been elected president, therefore had not really earned the job, and therefore that he, Ronald Reagan, had as much right to, you know, seek the presidency as Gerald Ford did.
Thank you.
But there's no question in my mind, had Ford been elected, we'd have been out there working for Ford in the primaries. Reagan would not have gone near that.
Arthur Stocker.
Mr. Meltzer, I'm sure when you were in the White House, you must have had an opportunity to observe George Bush and his interaction. Mm-hmm. Would you care to make any comments on the contrasts or whatnot between George Bush as a personality and an administrator and Ronald Reagan?
Well, I think George Bush is a much more hands-on administrator than Ronald Reagan was. I think that he spent 8 years observing Reagan's strengths and weaknesses and has tried to benefit from them. I think that George Bush has changed some as a politician over those 8 years. I think he's a little more laid back, a little less excitable than he was. I think he learned from Reagan that you don't have to get all overwrought on these things. And if you watch him, I think George Bush is, and I'm speaking now, I'm not speaking about issues, but I'm speaking as a man acting as president, has been a very effective president. He's become a stronger gives the appearance of being a stronger president than he did as vice president. He's a little more low-key. His voice doesn't put those high notes. His wrists don't flap quite as much. I think he's handled the job of being president as far as people's perspective of it. I think he's handled that very well.
Any other, Mrs. Griswold?
This is a sort of a nitpicking
question. Well, that's all right.
I cannot recall any other, the people in any other administration at the end of their terms accepting British honors, other than Ronald Reagan and Caspar Weinberger. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know anything about it. I don't know. I don't know whether that's good or bad. I would. My own feeling is I would be. If I'd been asked, I'd have said, I don't think it's quite proper. On the other hand, I don't think it's proper for a former president to go out and take money to make speeches and those sorts of things. I frankly am a little disappointed there. I think the ex-presidency is, like the presidency, is unique in the world, and I think you have to be very careful that you keep the standards of the ex-presidents, of the office of ex-president, as it were, very high. And, you know, I will say, if you look at Richard Nixon, whether you like him or not, he's never taken a nickel for making speeches since he's been out of office. He has, I think he has handled that office with dignity and stature that Gerald Ford is not, that Jimmy Carter is not, and that Ronald Reagan is not.
Any other questions? Well, this certainly has been one of the most informative of all the Reagan oral history sessions we've had. I should let you in on a dirty little secret. Lynn Nofziger was perfectly happy to come later in the year, but we wanted to keep the momentum of this Reagan oral history going. We wanted somebody who was a little closer than the second Secretary of Agriculture or others that we have had to Ronald Reagan to speak with us, and we therefore implored Mr. Nofziger to come now, but then come again later for a session with the students if possible. So it's by his goodwill and good graces that he come back from California, not the red eye special, but almost as bad, and come immediately here. And I think you should know that he's made some personal sacrifices in joining us. So we thank you very much.
As I said, nobody ever let me talk this long.